poet and painter. The title of this poem is Shutting the Door of a Tiny Study. I asked my husband, who works outside it, to do a panel in grass writing. Magic enters his word. It is wild, changed. I am overjoyed. That's the title. Now here's the poem. Grass writing, by the way, is an alternate form of calligraphy. The classical calligraphy really is in follows two schools, maybe more than that, but I know two schools. One is the well-formed figures that we conventionally see, and the other was which we see in there are certainly samples of it in the best museums, and Metropolitan has some wonderful examples of grass writing. It's a very wild, free stroke, and she was encouraging her husband to do this panel in grass writing. As pirates from South River overran the great Northeast, and as people flowed from the raging land, precisely then I dared to name my house Contented Hut. And why must they despise contentment, snatched from the flames of war? Oh, the heart's contentment is never illicit. Both earth and sky perceive no shame in it. Must I walk in a mansion down long corridors of rooms? My spare, ordered house is snug as a little boat. In it, reading a small scroll uplifts me. Nor do I read for reputation. Fame holds hands with slander. I overlook fleet horses, tall silken carriages. Glory comes on foot. A spoon of rice, something to drink. There's no shame in frugality. Sometimes, as a poet, I become arrogant, bemoaning how bitterly I work to make a poem that will rival the great Du Fu. Frenzied, I extend a panel. I demand you write upon it. Soon your brush begins, a snake, a dragon. I'm happy. Deep is my sigh. Yayushi, I attain unspeakable joy as you throw your brush and transform a single word into a rainbow. One final sweep, and a living whale opens the white sparkle of sea. This next poem is called In the Center of the Soup. The strange power of fever drives the sick room, our bed, our lamps feeding us into a new land. You and your smile arriving first, as though you are wrapped around a kiosk in our room, forever advertising aspirin or offering a glass of apple juice with foreign labels. This heat drives hard, making us both uncertain of the weather. Chills bring on the promises of science. I might be in the 21st century, unrecognizable, my love, a lady waiting for someone's sperm to thaw as she sits alone, having a capsule for dinner, with her glasses on, quaking cold. Better to be in bed with a hot flu and you at the far end stroking my foot. All postponement, the kettle whispering under its breath, and I not quite following the conversation. Eyes glaze, drinks spill on the linens, the universe boils faster and faster, arriving on schedule in my afflicted horoscope. Illness before the 21st is no surprise. My forehead sweats. I ask our whereabouts. Is this the inn? I fear the cook we came to try has left. You say, from far away, try the broth. I say, where are you? Why has the light gone out of the center of the soup? Are the trees bare? Does the maid have a sweater on? But you are calling from beneath the darkened broth. You'll be all right, you say. Let's leave this country in a few more days. No one here cares about the weather. The next poem is a sestina, and it is a six stanza poem. It has a particular form, and the six lines, that each stanza has six lines. The word at the end of the line, of each line, appears again in every other stanza, so that you have the same six words repeated in each case. The last stanza is three lines, and the words are repeated in the midline and at the end of the line. So see if you can catch the words. This is rather an apocalyptic poem. It's called The Coming of the Ice. Love, the last mushroom on September's hill, dies before the worst of winter strikes. shrinks that mild brown head and bends its neck in self-protection as the cold glares down, white as midnight, opulent as ice, turning its bland heat within to poison. You, love, are lethal now, tough and poisoned privately among soft memories. Sex dies last, patience first. A thin ice sheets the bed. Everyone knows that shrinks and mystics eat mushrooms. A jackal glares in the eye, a viper coils at the neck. I cannot blame you, love. Necrology is not good reading. Poisoned by night gardens, blinded by glares of zoo animals who never die, you are preoccupied, your cells heavy. You shrink from touch. Is it you, clutching, expecting the clutch of ice? But all is not up with us. Ice has the property of melting, flows through the neck of the beaker as water, and what shrinks fits once more as the effects of the poison show, frailty becoming sinew. As a cell dies, another multiplies. Between them, there is only the glare. Think of it, living so seductive and death glaring over every shoulder, children have the eyes of potatoes, sprouting tiny vines, their flesh cut into dice for replanting after they witness this neck and neck race with death. Relieved, they recover their poise and stretch their arms to the sky. Our distance shrinks as a world threatened by war shrinks. We huddle under the mushroom before the glare of the glacier's eye fixes us, before the poisoned waters freeze our history. Our status in the pre-ice age alters rapidly. No longer stiff-necked, love, we rush home. Fear, cruel as the hyena at the zoo, dies. Under the glacier's glare, we shout, stick our necks out. The oozing mushroom shrinks above the massed ice. Whoever dies first eludes the poison. The title of this poem is After Babi Yar. Bring down the dead, the martyrs say. Spread supper on the underground tables. I who marched the long march can no longer serve. Survivors have put an end to making heroes of victims. The community of martyrs waits for me in earth. Root to branch, north to south, foot to mouth, the family has been boned. The massacres, oh, the massacres I witnessed, held to my duty through Babi Yar and My Lai and Beirut, as I saw others holding to theirs for me. Earth ached in its roots, and I threw off my sandals to ease the pain. I tried escaping my complicity. The getaway car was ready. As I pressed the accelerator, others climbed into the rear. They held a gun to my head, though we were all looking for the way out. Each one for himself, they said. We went back to our tasks. I say there has never been anything like it. This age is wild. The dying process their own deaths. Surgeons flee the operating rooms. Scientists' machines burn in the sun like tanks in the Sinai. Our mothers and fathers have crated their beds and set off. Unpraised, the victims walk the earth, jam into airports, mount the observatories of the West. The sky cannot cover them. The graves are sealed. The earth bulges underneath. And the victims cry out to each other that they can walk no further, that they too are deserving. This one is called A Psalm of Incompleteness. And unfortunately, a poet just has to write, doesn't have to explain things. So. We do all have the feeling, I think, at one time or another, if we could only finish something. To sniff brine in the air, the plausible hurricane after the scorching summer, a routine meteorology like tasting passion on a friend's lips after dinner. To gulp Chopin, then dinner in a small cafe near the museum. The phrase of a nocturne that will not abate, pitches against the skull as one eats, rolls from ear to ear, strikes the back of an eye, wanting modulation, and at last displaces itself. To hear the ring of copper, to hear displaced from the mountain where we cabin ourselves, the voices of those who dismantle the copper pipes, snatch jalousies from the porch, pry loose the sinks, and we, locked in the back bedroom, never knowing that just below, They are building Jerusalem, the city of God. Oh God, see for yourself how we wait in back rooms, how the moon, like an old messiah, grunts out upon the beaches, how only one band of record repeats and repeats, how we see in the eye of the hurricane that incompleteness is our final state. This one is called The Doctrine of the Last Hour, and it is about that awful time in the 19th century, in the Industrial Revolution, when people worked very long hours, children worked 10 to 12 hour days. And along came an English economist by the improbable name of Nassau Senior. Here in Locust Valley, it sounds like a senior citizen, and Glenn Keller. But his name was Nassau Senior, and he said, the whole net profit derives from work done during the last hour of a 10-hour day. And that was his promulgation. The doctrine of the last hour. Does the doctrine of the last hour govern your life, cage you in, your hands feverish and constant as electricity until the hour before you die? Is this the hour, the occasion for fit profit-taking, all energies till now murdered in the manufacture of a life, at last, to be alone with gain? I see you, mad as Kafka's hunger artist, on view before a hooting mob, with your lunch pail swinging, going to and from the sorrows of a hated job. Soon someone must carry you, like a Victorian child still asleep, to your place at the machine this hour before the last, not to squander a minute's time in the manufacture of your life. Yet only the final hour renders gain, and through all the others you must endure, endure the long years, time that alters worth and memory, that is your cumulative power, that is your money in the bank. Look about you. Others have just begun. They do not know the doctrine of the last hour and work for every hour as if the final profitless blast could blow at noon. That is actually a fact. They used to carry the children in still asleep and set them down before the machine so that as they woke up, they wouldn't lose a minute and start working like that. I have two more poems. This one is for Giorgio Morandi, who was a Italian artist, contemporary artist, and had a retrospective in the Guggenheim Museum last year. Morandi chiefly did still lifes and worked at his still lifes through a lifetime dedicated to his craft and to his art. No matter what was happening in Italy, what was happening in the world, he went on with his still lifes. I'm dedicating this to Saul Levine, who sent me to see Morandi in the first place. Have you heard of the still lifes of Morandi? Listen, it is the best of times. And the universe of things whispers mutinously in cupboards, funnel and teapot, fast in solidarity. These are the things he lifts into light. They refuse to be cubed, yet the canvas must take them on. When the first gun sounds, they are unready for war, a last dark line of defense. Conscientious cup, flask, pitcher receive their arsenal of light, construct their own peace. Shelf over my desk, blue mug, brown lamp, long-handled metal stapler. I have known the etiquette in you, your promiscuous dust and light. Have dreamed and redreamed you as I placate sleep. Have you seen the still lifes of Morandi? Canvas after canvas, flash memories of pouring, painting, spooning. Light hovers on what we have. We live, often living still, light years from its source. All over the world, cups and saucers give back light like comets. And this is the last poem I wrote just a couple of weeks ago for about a very lovely night that I had. It started out in a terrific rainstorm. It was members' night at the Metropolitan Museum for the Manet opening. Got the inspiration for it, I guess, after a line from Wallace Stevens. The line is on the pleasures of merely circulating. Members night for Manet. Members are characters on the high seas whose crossing time is approximate. Rain undoes appointments, those confidences of time like airfield lights that eventually guarantee a landing. Meanwhile, if Manet is safe and bone dry, if I shake my umbrella and scan the fashionable men, know the amphibian delight of those who slither in and look for a friend, mate, lover. If I hear a girl say she left Rosalind at 4, if the brown night sky looks in, if I see everyone at once, all the living creatures, all the raincoats ever made, all the lovers like stones dropped into different lakes, and if still you do not come, how long can I study the faces, each a drawing wet and set against stone to dry? Tonight the Met is Dender fronting the Nile, while suppliants look anywhere for refuge. And there is a touch on the shoulder, the brush of wool on my arm, the bend of the head, the smile, and yes, the heart is a wedding, and the eye is the nostalgia of our youth, and the lips know the pleasures of nearly meeting.